Okay, so I guess we'll start. Today what we're going to do is we're going to continue on with our discussion of linear transformations. What we saw on Monday was that the linear transformations, they're related to matrices, and I'll review that at the start. Then, just like matrices, we could associate subspaces to matrices. Similarly, we'll be able to assign two subspaces to a linear transformation, and in fact, because of the connection with matrices, we'll actually be able to find bases for these subspaces. And if I have time, I'll talk about the dimension of these two subspaces and how you actually combine multiple linear transformations to create other linear transformations. Which is kind of mathematical, but actually part of the point of linear algebra in particular, but today's lecture is that to relate these abstract things, linear transformations, to concrete calculational setting. That's why we bring in matrices, because they give us numbers that we can actually work with rather than abstract ideas. Okay, so let me start by reminding you that a linear transformation is a function between two vector spaces. And it's not an arbitrary function. We require it to be compatible with our vector space operations. So in particular, we want it to behave nicely with respect to scalar multiplication of vectors. And so here, if we multiply a vector before we apply the function, we get the same result as if we had applied the function to the bare vector and then do the scalar multiplication. So inside the parentheses, we're doing scalar multiplication of vectors inside the domain or M, and then on the left right-hand side of this equation, we're doing the scalar multiplication after we've already reached n-dimensional vectors by the application of that function. And similarly, we want it to behave well with respect to vector addition. So whether we add vectors before or after we apply the linear transformation, we want to get the same result. General functions are not going to have these very special properties. And in fact, these are so special that the functions end up being really simple. Basically, the only way you can create such a function is through them essentially, they have to be functions that are related to matrix multiplication. And I'll show you that next. First of all, if you have a matrix with n rows and m columns, you can use that matrix to create a function that will take you from an m-dimensional vector space to an n-dimensional vector space. All you need is matrix multiplication. So how is that going to work? So you take a vector that lives inside Rm, and for this you create an m by 1 column vector. So I take that vector and I want to interpret it as a matrix so I can perform matrix multiplication. Then I multiply these m-dimensional column vectors, I multiply them by this n by m matrix because the number of columns is equal to the number of rows that multiplication is defined, and what it will produce is another column vector, but now one that has n separate rows in it. And that's you then interpret as an element of Rn. So what this matrix multiplication is doing is taking you from m-dimensional vectors and it's kicking out as a result n-dimensional vectors. So we do get a map between these two vector spaces using matrix multiplication. And in fact, it's easy to verify that the function that you define this way naturally satisfies these two properties because scalar multiplication is going to commute with matrix multiplication. And when you multiply a sum of vectors by a matrix, that matrix multiplication just distributes over that sum. X plus y is just going to equal ax plus ay. It distributes. The matrix multiplication distributes over vector addition. So these two properties are going to be automatic when I create a function using a matrix. What we saw last time is that we can go in the opposite direction as well. If I have a function, that satisfies these two properties, I can construct a matrix that will have the same action. The way this guy acts on a vector is going to be the same thing as a matrix multiplication. The only thing I lack on this slide so far is a recipe for how to construct this matrix from a given function satisfying those properties. But here's the recipe. What we do is, first of all, we take E1 through EM, a set of M vectors that's going to be the standard basis for an M-dimensional vector space. And the way we get these vectors is we just use the natural coordinate directions. E2 is going to equal 0, 1, 0, etc. So these are the standard basis vectors. Taking linear combinations of these vectors, we can reach any point inside Rm. And so what we do, since these guys are easy to create, here's the recipe. We can, each of them is going to be an M-dimensional vector, so we can apply the transformation to it. That's going to take us over to a vector with n entries, and we write them vertically. That creates a matrix with n rows for each component of where we land, and then we have essentially m different starting points. So we have, in this m-dimensional space, we're going to have exactly m standard basis vectors. So as soon as you've got a function satisfying these properties, you can construct this matrix. And for a given function, this is just going to be a matrix of numbers. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to take this abstract definition and bring it into a calculable setting. All right, so that much we covered last time. And in fact, a little bit of what I'm about to say we covered last time as well. Just like we did for matrices, we're going to attach subspaces to a function between two vector spaces that behaves like a linear transformation. For a matrix, the way we got subspaces is, well, we can look at the row vectors of this matrix and take all possible linear combinations of them. That will create a subspace of, well, each row is going to have exactly m entries. So this is going to be a subspace of Rm. Or alternatively, we can focus on the column vectors of the matrix. Each column, of which there are m, it's going to have exactly as many entries in that column as you have rows. And so the column vectors are all going to be n-dimensional vectors. Their span is going to be a subspace of the vector space of n-dimensional vectors. And finally, we also have another matrix, another subspace we can attach to a matrix. Given a matrix, we can interpret it as a coefficient matrix of a homogeneous linear system, and then we can look at the solution set of this system. That's going to be a subspace of the space of variables, which will be a subspace of Rm. All right, now, last week we talked about each of these subspaces and how to find bases for these. We're going to use that material because what we've just seen is to a given function between two vector spaces, a linear transformation, we can attach a matrix. And so what's going to turn out to be the matrices, the subspaces we attach to a linear transformation is actually going to correspond to column spaces and null spaces of the associated matrix. So that's what's going to be shown today. But the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to define subspaces attached to a function between two vector spaces. I'm going to define it in such a way that does not refer to an underlying matrix, but rather is only using sort of function theory. So let's put the function theory up. Here we have sort of abstract function theory, not abstract in the sense of difficult, but in the sense that it's really kind of loosely defined. We have a set A, a set B, a function that takes you from the set A to the set B, meaning a rule. But once you choose a point A inside here, you have a rule that specifies a corresponding image point, image of A by the function F. Now, when you collect together all the points in the, this is so the codomain, and this set A is called the domain. Once you have this rule, you can look in the codomain, the target space, so to speak, and you can figure out all the points in the codomain that are reachable by applying that function. It's not necessarily the whole space. If you take a function, say f of x, let's write it f from the real line to the real line that sends x to x squared. Well, the image of this function, the set of points in the, on the real line that are reachable by this function, is not the entire real line. You're only going to reach the positive, or actually the non-negative real numbers when you square them. So whether or not x is positive or negative, its square is going to be non-negative. So I don't get the entire codomain by application of this function. That's the image of a function. It's precisely the points that you can reach in the codomain by application of that function. So that's going to be the set point B in the codomain such that B is equal to F of A for some A inside the domain. All right, now this is just, let's not call it abstract. Let's just call it general function theory. If you have a function, you have a codomain, and then you have this image set. What we're going to look at now is this situation, but specialized to the case when our function is between two vector spaces and the function is a linear transformation. So the range of a linear transformation from Rm to Rn is going to be exactly the same thing as the image of that function, but the way we'll set it up is I'll now describe it linear algebraically. It's going to be all the vectors that live, it's going to be all the vectors that live in the codomain, so y inside Rn, just like we have b inside, little b inside b, such that y is equal to t of x for some x inside the domain, which is Rm. All right, so that's a set, every point of which is an element of Rn. What I want to show you is that, in fact, this set, range of a linear transformation, is not only a set, a subset of Rm, it's actually going to be a subspace of Rm. And once I've shown you that, I'll show you how we can actually calculate it by constructing the matrix corresponding to a linear transformation and looking at the column space of that matrix. All right, so let's move ahead here a little bit. Here's the image as I defined it here. And then the range is just a specialization of this notion of images to our linear algebraic situation where a function is going between two vector spaces, and it's also a linear transformation. All right, so first thing I'll show you is that the subset, notice that every point in it is an element of Rm. So this range is going to be a subset of this vector space. What we want to show is it's actually a subspace. So we want to check that it's closed under scalar multiplication and closed under vector addition. So more precisely, what we want to show is that if we start off with a number and a vector that lives inside that set, after we do the scalar multiplication, we don't leave the set. And similarly, if we have two vectors that start off in that set, we add them together, we don't leave that set. These are the conditions that make a set or subset into a subspace. And it's kind of analogous to what we did when we defined linear transformations. Constantly in linear algebra, we're demanding some sort of compatibility property between the object that we're trying to describe, whether it's a subspace or a linear transformation, and our two fundamental vector space operations, scalar multiplication and vector addition. All right, so what I'm going to show you now is sets that I construct in this fashion by looking at all the points I can reach by applying a linear transformation, that those sets are closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition. So first I'll show you that it's closed under scalar multiplication. So let's start with a point that lives in this set. That means if it actually must have come from some point living inside the domain Rm up here, a place where we start off. And so if I have a point that lives in the range, it must have come from some x that lives inside Rm. What I'll do is I'll take this equation, I'll multiply it by some number lambda and get directly this. But what I want you to observe that though, because T is a linear transformation, and we have that compatibility with scalar multiplication and the action of the function, I could take this factor of lambda and I can move it inside without changing the value. So lambda T of lambda x is always equal to lambda times T of x when T is a linear transformation. But then the extreme sides of this equation shows that this new point, the scalar multiple of my given point by lambda, is also in the image. It's also in the range of T because this guy here has been displayed as the value of the function T at a particular point. So that the extreme sides of this equation show that lambda y is also living in the range because it's a value. It's the value of lambda x. And so if you have a point in the range and you have an arbitrary number, the scalar multiple of that vector by lambda still remains inside that set. And so the range of T is seen to be closed under scalar multiplication. Similarly, we can look at vector addition. Start off with two points that are essentially come from our domain by the application of this function T. So we'll set it up this way. We'll suppose Y1 came from some guy X1 living inside the domain, Y2 came from X2 coming in the domain. These conditions are just stating explicitly what we mean by Y1 and Y2 living inside the range. What I'm going to do is I'll add those two equations together, and then that's what I'll get right away. But because T is a linear transformation, this vector addition can either be calculated before I apply the function, as we would here, or after I apply the function, should get the same result if T is a linear transformation. But then that shows you that the sum of these two vectors is still lies in the image of the function T, because here's the guy, the vector x1, x2, which produces this guy after we apply the function. All right, and so now we've seen that if we start off with two vectors in the range, if we add them together, it still lives inside the range. And so the range is closed under vector addition. And now we've got it's a subspace, because anytime you have a subset of a vector space that's closed under scalar multiplication, closed under vector addition, meaning when you apply those operations, you don't leave this set, well, that means it's a subspace. All right, so I've got a set or a subset a subset of the codomain that's now been demonstrated to be a subspace of the codomain. What we'll do next is we'll find a basis for it. All right, so what I'm going to show you next is that if you have a linear transformation, you create the corresponding matrix as we did in Monday's lecture by noticing how T acts on the standard basis vectors and using those results to construct a numerical matrix. What I'll show you next is that this subspace of the codomain is actually exactly the same thing as the column space of this matrix. All right, now I'm going to show you this indirectly. So what I'm, the idea of the argument here it's going to be analogous to if I know that I have two numbers, x, y. Now, don't think of them as vectors. Just think of them as numbers. If I know that x is less than or equal to y, and I also know that y is less than or equal to x, well, these two inequalities can only hold when x is equal to y, right? So this is usually not the way you show that two things are the same, but if both of these conditions are true, it must be that x is equal to y. Well, the argument we're going to do to show that these sets are the same is we'll show you that if A is a subset of B and B is a subset of A, that these two conditions are equivalent to saying that the two sets are the same. And so that's the way I'm going to show you that these two sets are the same. I'm going to show you that every element that sits in the range is also in the column space of the associated matrix, and that every element in the column space of the associated matrix is also lies in the range of the given transformation. So remember the column space, that's what you get by taking linear combinations of the columns of this matrix. The range, well, that's what you get by figuring out where a given linear transformation, let me put the linear transformation picture up here. Now we're going from Rm, we're calling it T, and it's going from Rm to Rn, and we're ending up in another vector space, Rn. So that's the picture we're looking at. And the range of T is exactly the points in the codomain such that y equals T of x for some x in the domain Rm, as opposed to the column space of AT, which is a set of all possible linear combinations. Say C1 times the first column of AT plus dot, 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 plus C, let's see, that will be exactly M columns. Column M of A subscript T, and then I let those coefficients range over the entire real line. So when you actually write these two sets down, they don't look like one another, but my claim is they're exactly the same set, even though they don't appear to be. And it's actually not so hard to show this correspondence because, in fact, the columns of AT, the way they're prescribed is by looking how T acts on the standard basis vectors. So I'll show you this. I'll show you that if I grab an element from this set, it's automatically going to be in this set. And if I grab an element of this set, it's automatically interpretable as an element of this set. And so this sort of logic for showing that the two sets are equal will work. All right, so let's start choosing an element that lives in the range of T. So I'll write it, since it's in the range, it has to come from some vector in the some x over here, and it's going to end up as T of x over here. And what I'm going to show you is that I have a vector in the codomain that came from the domain by application of the function, that's where I'm staying there, that in fact, it's also an element of this set. So how does that work? Here's just as that equation. Now what I'll do is I'll take this vector x and I'll expand it in terms of the standard basis for the domain Rm. There'll be exactly m standard basis vectors that will coordinatize this vector space. Take an arbitrary vector, I expand it in terms of the standard basis. Then I use the property that T is a linear transformation to take the sum of vectors and replace it by, linear transformations, they're compatible with vector addition. So effectively, the sum of vectors upon which I apply this function can, the same value which would be occurred if I took the individual vectors, applied the function, and then summed everything up. So that's the second property of a linear transformation. The first property is that behaves well with respect to scalar multiplication as well. Whether I scalar multiply before I apply the function or after I apply the function, if I have a linear transformation, I get the same result. But now, given the way this matrix is constructed, T applied to the standard basis vectors is giving you, by definition, exactly the columns of this matrix. And so what I have is an element in the range now being expressed as a linear combination of the columns of A, just numbers times these column vectors. So that puts Y inside the column space. And so I've shown you one of these conclusions. One, the range, everything that's in the range is also going to live inside the column space of the associated matrix. Next, I'll show you that if I take a vector that lives in the column space, it corresponds to a vector that also lives inside the range. So take a point in the column space. Well, by definition, that means it has to be a linear combination of column vectors. So let's write it out that way. These column vectors, on the other hand, from the way this matrix was defined, each column corresponds to the application of T to a standard basis vector of the domain. And so just replace these column vectors by the corresponding application of T to a standard basis vector. We get that. And now, we use the properties of linear transformation. These scalar multiplications can be, this term here is exactly equal to this. The scalar multiplication after we apply the linear transformation is the same thing as T applied to the scalar multiple of the starting vector anyway. And similarly, because we're adding up linear transformations are compatible with vector addition, I can do these vector sums after or before I apply the linear transformation, and I should get the same result. These two steps are properties of the linear transformation. But now we see that W can be obtained by applying T to a particular vector. Well, that means that this W lies inside the range of T. The range is all the points you can reach by applying this function. So evidently, W can be reached by applying T to this particular vector. And so we've shown that every element in the range lives in the column space, every element in the column space lives in the range, and the two sets are equal. Okay, now that's really ideal. The problem I'm working toward addressing is I have this abstract subspace. How do I find a basis for it so I can actually talk about particular vectors that live inside this range? How do I coordinatize this subspace? Well, I need a basis. Because these subspaces are, in fact, the same vector space, I can calculate a basis for this and then use it as a basis for the range. And since they're the same subspace, well, we get this corollary. A basis for the range of a linear transformation can be found by finding a basis for the column space. And that we learned how to do last week. Let me remind you, to find a basis for the column space of any matrix A, whether or not it comes from a linear transformation or not, we have the following procedure. You row reduce A to, usually we go all the way to reducible echelon form, but it suffices to go to row echelon form. And then you note where the pivots live. In that row echelon form. And then the basis vectors for the column space are obtained by grabbing the columns. You grab the corresponding columns, not of the row echelon form, but of the original matrix A. So you grab the corresponding columns of A. All right, let me do this explicitly with an example. Here's a function. So you're taking a point with coordinates x1 and x2, and it's producing after the application of that, it's producing a three-dimensional vector with coordinates x1 plus x2, x1 minus x2, and x1. So that's a function. Clearly, for every pair of numbers, every element of R2, we get a three-dimensional vector. What I want to do is find a basis for the range of that function. That's going to be defined by this. But the way we'll calculate it is by finding an equivalent matrix and then calculating its column space using this algorithm. So first step, let's get that corresponding matrix. The way it's defined is you look at at where you're starting and then use the standard basis vectors for that vector space. Again, those standard basis vectors, let me put them over here. You create them simply by writing down vectors that have a single non-zero component in a particular slot. And if you have vectors inside Rm, that means there's going to be exactly m slots here. The last standard basis vector is going to be that. And so as soon as I know what my domain is, I can immediately construct these standard basis vectors. But they're still going to be vectors inside the domain of this function t. So I can then evaluate the function t at those standard basis vectors, and I'll get numerical results. So now the abstraction has disappeared, and we're working with a matrix with just numbers as their entries. All right, so this matrix is going to be the matrix that corresponds to this function. Notice that even though in specifying this function, I sort of wrote the value out as a horizontal vector, when I construct this matrix, it's necessary to write the answer vertically. So for example, this first guy, t applied to the first standard basis vector, well, that's going to be when x1 is equal to 1 and the second component is equal to 0. So when I substitute 1 for x1, 0 for x2, I'm going to get 1 plus 0 is 1, 1 minus 0 is 1, and 1. Well, the second component, now x2 is going to equal 1, and x1 is going to equal to 0. So I'll get 0 plus 1 is 1, 1 0 minus 1 is negative 1, and then x1 is equal to 0 for the second standard basis vector, so I get 0. So you just evaluate the function at the standard basis vectors to get the results, and you arrange them as columns. All right, now, because these two sets are identical to one another, what we'll do is we'll find a basis for this space. They're the same vector space, so I'll just use this calculation to find a basis for the column space, and I'll use that basis as a basis for the range. That means taking my given matrix, row reducing it to row echelon form, then noting where the pivots live. that's the first step. The second step is to figure out where the pivots live. And we have a pivot in the first column and the second column. To get the basis for the column space of this matrix, I go back to the original matrix and I grab the columns of the original matrix that correspond to the columns of the row echelon form where the pivots live. Well, there are pivots in both columns. So I grab the first column and the second column. And I write them down. I'm writing them down as horizontal vectors because in this setting, I'm thinking of this as going from a two-dimensional vectors to three-dimensional vectors, not necessarily as a two-by-one matrix going to a three-by-one matrix. I'm thinking these as vectors. I'm just writing them horizontally. So this last step where I write this column vector, when I write it horizontally, that's simply because I'm now interpreting it as a vector rather than as a column vector, a 3x1 matrix. All right, so that's it. That's what you do. To find a basis for the range of T, you construct the corresponding matrix, and then you find a basis for the column space of that matrix using the standard algorithm. Okay, let's see, I'll keep that picture up. The next thing I want to talk about, though, is a second subspace that we can attach to a function between two vector spaces. This one is again going to be defined using function theory ideas, but we'll quickly relate it to the matrix that corresponds to our given function. Here's the set we're interested in this case. It's going to be the set of all vectors in the domain that get sent to the zero vector. So this range of T, it's a subspace of the codomain. What I'm going to describe next is going to be the kernel of T. If my function is taking m-dimensional vectors to n-dimensional vectors, unlike the range, which lives over here, the kernel is going to be a subspace of the domain. And in fact, what it is, it's a set of points inside your domain that gets sent to the zero vector. So the guys here are going to get sent not to the range, it is going to land in the range, but the point is that they all go to one point, the zero vector. And so that's the idea of the kernel. It's all the things that sit in the domain that somehow get mapped to the zero vector inside the codomain under the application of your function T. All right, so that's the set. Every element of this is a element of the domain, and so it's a subset of the domain. I'll show you really quickly that it's also a subspace of that domain, but I won't do it by showing that it's closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition. Rather, I'm going to show that this set is actually a subspace of the domain by showing how to relate it to the original matrix or the associated matrix AT. And here's the statement that this kernel, the set of vectors in the domain, is actually equal to the null space of this matrix. Remember, the null space of any matrix, whether it comes from a linear transformation or not, this is defined as the solution set of a linear system associated with this matrix, the solution set of A times X is equal to zero. All right, so what I'll show you is that every element in this kernel, every vector in the domain that gets sent to the zero vector also satisfies the equation AT times that vector is equal to zero. And that's all we have to do is write down the result. So we take a vector that lives inside the kernel, then necessarily, by the definition of what the kernel is, T of x has to equal zero. But if I have a linear transformation, I can also construct this associated matrix. The purpose of this matrix is that the action of the function can be replicated by matrix multiplication. So as soon as I construct this matrix, this identity is true. But now you see that if you have a vector that gets sent to zero, its multiplication by this matrix X must also equal to zero. So it must satisfy this equation. And so the two sets are going to be exactly the same. And so the conclusion then is that the null space of the matrix is going to be exactly the same thing as the kernel. And so in fact, what we can do is we can calculate this guy by calculating this instead, which is great because when we're looking at this guy, it's just a matrix of numbers. While this guy is defined more abstractly via this definition. All right, so let's do an example where we actually compute the kernel of a linear transformation. I have a new linear transformation, this one that's going to take three-dimensional vectors to two-dimensional vectors. And what I'll propose to do in this example is find a basis for the kernel of this linear transformation. I'm going to find a basis for this set. All right, now that turns out to be equivalent to the null space of the associated matrix. And so what I'm going to have to do to find a basis for this set, we'll look at the same set, but expressed a different way as the solution set of a linear system. And I'll just solve this linear system to find the elements that live here. How do we do that? Well, we write down the matrix. And so here I've done that. T applied to the first standard basis vector is going to be 1 minus 0. And then the second component is going to be 0 minus 0, or 0. So I just substitute in for E1, one of the standard basis vectors to get each of these columns. And then I evaluate the result and write it vertically. That matrix is easily constructed. And now what we'll try to do is find the solution set of this matrix times up. I guess a three-dimensional vector has to equal zero. So we take the matrix, we row reduce it to its reduced row echelon form. So I do elementary row operations to systematically, well, the pivots are already equal to one. I need to clear out this entry above the pivot to get it in reduced row echelon form. Once I reach reduced row echelon form, I convert back to equations. I also look at the reduced row echelon form to decide which variables I'm going to regard as free and which variables I'll regard as fixed. The fixed variables come from columns of the row echelon form that have pivots. And the columns, the variables that correspond to columns without pivots, those are your free variables. We take the equations coming from the matrix in row echelon, reduced row echelon form. We express the fixed variables in terms of the free variables. Then we try to write down the solution vector. Sorry, that's written incorrectly. That solution vector should have been I have x without any restrictions on it. It's going to be a three-dimensional vector. But once I put these two conditions on the components, I'll get x1 is going to equal x3, x2 is going to equal x3, and x3 already equals x3. And then this is x3 times 1, 1, 1. All right, so every solution is going to be a scalar multiple of this vector. And so, in fact, this vector 1, 1, 1 is a basis for the solution set. So it's a basis vector for the solution set. But that, because the solution set, AT of x times x is equal to zero, is exactly equal to the kernel of the corresponding linear transformation, what we get from that vector is a basis vector for the kernel of T, because we've seen that that kernel of T is the same thing as the null space of the associated matrix. So I use the matrix to calculate this basis vector. And so in the end, I think I've got this written. Yeah, this is written incorrectly. This should be a vector 1, 1, and it has the third component 1. So please ignore the typo. I'll fix that as soon as I get back to my office. All right, and so there we go. We have two subspaces attached to a linear transformation. Let's see if I can put a full picture up so you can see how this works. So we have a linear transformation from an m-dimensional space to an n-dimensional space. This is going to correspond to an N by M matrix. So that's one idea that we've been using today. And the second thing is that we have subspaces. Let's draw a picture. Let's say we have our M. Now I'm not going to write it as a circle. Let me write down some coordinate grid. So you think of this more as a vector space. It's being mapped over to a different vector space, Rn, by the application of some t that's going from m-dimensional vectors to n-dimensional vectors. Now, we've looked at two sets. On the codomain side, we've looked at the range of t, and it was all the vectors in the codomain that you reach by applying your function to some vector inside the domain. So let me sort of put a subset of that. But actually what it's going to be a subspace. So I shouldn't really be drawing this as a sort of a blob. It's going to be a subspace. So maybe some hyperplane that's embedded inside this space. But it consists of all the points that we can reach by applying this function. And what we've seen is that this thing is the same thing as the column space of the matrix. And that fact allows us to calculate this explicitly. There's another subspace, but it occurs over here on the domain side. It's the set of vectors. It's going to be a subspace. There's going to be some hyperplane in here that contains the origin. It consists of all the vectors that go exactly to the zero vector over here. That's also a subspace, and it's called the kernel of your transformation. It works out to be exactly the same thing as the null space of the associated matrix. This is going to be a numerical matrix, so something we can calculate with. We'll find a basis for this subspace by calculating the solution set of AT of x is equal to zero. So now we've got, the picture is now complete. Not only do I know how to deal with linear transformations, basically if I want to calculate anything, I'll convert it into a matrix. But then I can relate subspaces that are defined by their function properties. I can directly calculate them in terms of a numerical matrix. Okay, so let's see. I'll stop here today because I'm out of time. What I'm going to do on Friday is I'm going to count really quickly how many basis vectors I have in each of these subspaces, and then I'll be able to relate the dimensions of these two subspaces. Okay, so I'll stop here today, and we'll finish this up on Friday, and then we have spring break, and probably on Friday we'll also set the date for the second exam. So look at your schedules for the week after spring break, and we'll decide when would be the best date for the exam based on that. Yep.
Have a good one.
Yep, you too. Yep, see ya.